I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome back to the next Signals to Danger REIB Roundup. These are the episodes of the podcast where we look at current affairs in the world of railway safety, with a focus on the work of the Rail Accident Investigation Branch, but also exploring other safety concepts from time to time, or occasionally it's just me mumbling my somewhat uneducated opinions on things. My name is Dan Fox, and I'm the producer of the Signals to Danger podcast, and I'm a railwayman in my day-to-day life. I'm just coming out the back end of the secondment that I've been doing at work for the last few months, so that has meant a bit of catch-up stuff to close things off before I go back to the day job, so there has been a bit of a delay in this episode, but hopefully you can forgive that. Without any further ado, let's dive into our roundup. When I initially started to write this, I was, to be honest, worried a little bit that I wasn't going to have that much to talk about, but since then, it's safe to say there has been a bit of stuff going on. So without any further ado, let's get started.
Over 70 killed and about 200 injured near Lewisham in the worst rail crash since Harrow and Wheelstone.
Three people have died after a passenger train derailed near Stonehaven in Aberdeenshire this morning and caught fire.
And all the windows I could see were just orange, like the sun.
36 die in a South London train crash. Some who survived that were killed when a third train hit the wreckage.
This was, in the words of the coroner, a unique set of circumstances that have resulted in catastrophic consequences.
So we'll open up the episode proper then by taking a look at news stories which have dropped from the REIB and other sources since last time we spoke. First of all, we're going to start by heading to Pembrokeshire, specifically Fishguard, on the 4th of January this year, where a passenger train had a near miss with a track worker just before 10 a.m. in the morning. A small team had been carrying out vegetation clearance at the site and they were being supervised by a PIC, a person in charge. The PIC's responsibility is to make sure that the team is carrying out their work safely, and their duties and responsibilities are defined by Network Rail standards. In addition, those undertaking the role of PIC are required to be certified as competent to act as a controller of site safety, which gives us our second acronym of the episode, the COSS, C-O-S-S. The planned safe system of work for the activity being undertaken included an instruction that those clearing plants should remain at least 2 metres away from the running line at all time, fairly standard. So imagine the surprise of a driver when they rounded a tight curve on the approach to the worksite, travelling at 53 miles an hour, and saw a worker stood in the tracks. The driver, of course, stuck in the emergency brake, sounded his horn, and as a result the track worker, who happened to be the pick, managed to get clear of the line a whole 2 seconds before the train reached the spot that they were standing in. A scary situation for both the driver and the pick, and one that realistically could have been avoided. And this is relatively similar to many of the incidents that we've talked about the branch looking at in the past, so it's probably not that surprising that this one is going to lead into a safety digest, which we will of course be discussing in due course when it's released. The second REIB story to discuss is the origin of yet another safety digest, and that one relates to an incident that took place on the 6th of February. In the early hours, an accident took place on the Midland Main Line near to Braybrook in Northamptonshire. A possession was in place to allow work to take place and, as in many cases, road rail vehicles, which we have discussed recently on this podcast, were in use as part of the work. The RRVs in question were a sort of elevated work platform, so they had a small basket on the end of a hydraulic arm, and they were being moved around the worksite as part of the activity that was being undertaken. A worker was walking along the track, directing the movements of one of these RRVs on the adjacent line, when they were unfortunately struck by another RRV on the line that they were standing on. They received a leg injury in the incident, which required hospital treatment. As I briefly alluded to a couple of seconds ago, the branch has undertaken a preliminary examination into the circumstances surrounding this incident, and having assessed the evidence that's been gathered to date, they've decided that this will be another safety digest. So we will do what we always do and wait to see what comes out of that. We'll discuss it back here when both of those safety digests are released. Looking back to something that we discussed last roundup, I've obtained a little bit more information about that incident which saw an LNER service hit a temporary road rail access point on the East Coast Main Line. Got some additional details from Network Rail's Safety Central website. On the 19th of December 2023, at approximately 1 o'clock in the morning, an overhead line team planned to undertake an inspection on the south side of Stoke Tunnel, and that's near Grantham on the East Coast Main Line. A Unimog MEWP, so Mobile Elevated Work Platform machine, was required to work from the upfast and therefore manoeuvred across the permanent road rail access point, which was on the upslope. The team then attempted to on-track the machine onto the upfast using a temporary RRAP, but that was unsuccessful due to the inclement weather. Getting vehicles up onto these can sometimes be a bit difficult. I'd imagine, based on that it was possibly wet and it just couldn't get up onto the access point. So the team decided then at that point to put it onto the upslope and transit the machine south to transition to the upfast. The temporary access point wasn't removed immediately. The intention was that the team would off-track the machine at that place following the completion of the work. The machine itself started to malfunction when it was on the site, and the team decided that there was a high risk of failure and decided not to undertake the work and to return it back to the yard. In order to get it back as quickly as possible, it was taken off the track on the upslope, not the originally planned location on the upfast where that temporary access point was situated. It came off on the upslope, and that ramp, the access point on the upfast, was inadvertently left in place, and the team left site at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that detail that's included in that Safety Central brief does shed quite a bit of light on how that accident was allowed to take place. Makes it more understandable. You can sort of see where the jigsaw pieces lined up, although we will very much still be taking a look at the safety digest that is being generated by that incident when it drops onto the REIB's website. So, I imagine the more diligent ones of you out there might be sat there thinking, how can the news section be finished with the presence of three other significant incidents omitted? Well, never fear, my ear is still to the ground. and I haven't decided not to talk about the three derailments which have taken place over the last 2 months. I just wanted to look at them here in their own section. Derailments are just about the most serious type of incident which takes place on the railway, as I'm absolutely confident you will all be aware. Rail vehicles are clearly safest when they stay on the tracks themselves. Freight vehicles derailing is possibly a little more common for various reasons we might touch on in the future, but there have been two instances in March, and a third back in February, which have seen passenger trains derail, and not just passenger trains, but passenger trains in service with passengers on board. And we can't underestimate the seriousness of this. It's not a common occurrence, and to have three in such a short period of time is concerning, but worth looking into a little bit. The three incidences took place in different areas of the country, and there are three very different causes behind them, admittedly. But still, three in that short period of time is concerning. But let's start with that February derailment. So at about 20:53 on the 6th of February 2024, a train travelling between Liverpool, Lime Street and Norwich derailed after hitting trees that had fallen across the track from outside of the railway boundary. Quite a prominent issue at the moment, I'm sure you'll be aware if you've listened to this podcast before. The train was travelling at 83 miles an hour when that took place, and that's quite the speed and in the dark, which would leave anyone at the front end of that very little opportunity to react. The impact with the trees caused the leading the leading wheel set to derail. It then ran on the sleepers and ballast for about 680 metres before it came to a stop, and as a result, the emergency brake application helped that, but as we've discussed previously, wheels in the ballast is a really good way of slowing a train down as well. 31 passengers and two staff on board, and one passenger suffered a minor injury, and quite a good result, all things considered. This incident will be leading to a full investigation from the branch, and they've told us that as well as that sequence of events, they'll also be looking to consider the arrangements in place to manage and control the risks from trees falling onto the railway from outside the railway boundary. Something that the Broughty Ferry investigation will also be looking at. They'll also be looking at the structural crashworthiness performance of the cab during the collision, the performance of the train in remaining aligned with the track while running derailed, and, as we always hear, any underlying management factors. It's probably safe to say that the issue of vegetation from outside the railway ending up on the railway is really prominent at the moment. So with this in conjunction with that Broughty Ferry investigation, I will be really, really interested to hear what comes out of that. The railway can't necessarily be responsible for the land outside of its own property, but it should be interesting to see what happens there. Moving then on to the second derailment, and that brings us to Walton-on-Thames and the early hours of the 4th of March. So at around 5:40 in the morning, a passenger train travelling between Woking and Waterloo that struck a piece of redundant rail, scrap rail, on a railway access point on the approach to Walton-on-Thames. That train, travelling at about 85 miles an hour when that took place, which is again a really considerable speed for a train to be travelling when it derails. The leading set of wheels derailed, but the train itself remained upright and came to a stand about 500 metres beyond the point of collision, because the driver again stuck in the emergency brake. There were no injuries, but the train and, well, several hundred metres of infrastructure was considerably damaged. The train was the first one that had travelled along the Up Fast Line following engineering work that had taken place the previous weekend, and those works included tamping, ballasting, and scrap clearance, which, well, that would have included recovering redundant rails. And that that scrap clearance activity should actually have concluded about 26 hours prior to the incident taking place. It was the third train which had travelled in the up direction since the works, but the first one on the fast line. The other two would use the adjacent slow line, and we can add into this that a few minutes before the incident actually took place, one of those other trains had reported striking a possible branch or piece of wood as it had passed the area. This one, too, is going to form an investigation, and of course they will be establishing the sequence of events, but also focusing in on the planning and management of the work to recover the redundant rails, the arrangements to make sure that lines are safe for the passage of trains following engineering work, the actions of those involved, and any underlying management factors. Now, this does feel like it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it, because you would like to think that processes are in place to make sure that you do leave a work site in a safe condition. It's not an unreasonable thing to expect. And a big piece of rail is something that you'd kind of imagine wouldn't be that easy to miss. So very keen to see what comes out of that particular investigation. Alongside the RAIB activity, Network Rail's also issued advice to contractors covering the requirements for blindside equipment, reminding teams to keep the worksite tidy, not to leave items like cable drums, short rail lengths, and troughing unattended trackside, and also prompting discussions on how they can make sure that worksites are left clear. The third, and hopefully the final derailment, which we'll be able to talk about for a little while, is was very much something of a breaking news story still, so much in fact that the vehicles involved are still in situ at the time of me writing and recording this episode. On Friday the 22nd of March, very early morning, Northern train service between Preston and Barrow-in-Furness set out at 5:18 in the morning. Journey was normal, if not stupidly early in the morning, until the point where the train set out on the Furness line leading towards Grange over Sands. At 6 in the morning, the train left the station at Arnside with 4 passengers and 4 crew on it, and the 6 vehicles of the train, which was 2 Class 195s coupled together, proceeded out towards Grange. Shortly afterwards, on the approach to Grange over Sands station, the train derailed, with some of the leading vehicles colliding with the wall adjacent to the tracks running along that seawall section there. Luckily, everyone on board was evacuated safely. From what we can see in pictures, it looks like the front 3 vehicles have derailed. The rear 3 seem to be more or less on the tracks. Details are very much still emerging about what caused that derailment, but there is a pretty big smoking gun about 150 metres behind the point where the train came to a stand. A considerable void has opened up beneath the line that the train was travelling on. If you do follow me on Twitter, I shared a video of that void that someone shared with me. And safe to say, it really isn't conducive with the safe operation of trains. The RAIB is currently undertaking its initial investigations at the scene, although they may well have completed this by the time this episode goes out. There is speculation out there on the World Wide Web, on the forums and places like that, about the causes of this voiding. There are theories such as a collapsed culvert under the line, and others have flagged up that the land just inland of the line itself has seen significant flooding recently, with the adjacent road impassable on multiple occasions, so reasonably safe to say there's quite a bit of water in the area. Adding to this, that tamping was supposed to have been taking place in the days prior to the incident, and there are there's a lot of complex factors that are going to be needing to be considered as part of understanding what went on here. I'm really going to caveat this by saying I am not about to speculate myself what I believe may have taken place, because despite what I've read about the incident online and what people have sent me, I will stand by my usual line that we need to wait for official comms to tell us what is officially known about the incident today, and that's what I'll be quite happy to put out there. The vehicles are, like I said, still in place on the line there, and once the branch has completed that initial investigation, Network Rail is going to begin the complex recovery process, and their plans for that are to use a specialist Network Rail crane to re-rail and remove the train, then carry out repairs to the ground, install new ballast, and lay new track over the affected area. Almost in the way that a proper journalist would do this, I do like to occasionally share a quote that I've seen, and Chris Pye, who is Network Rail's Northwest Route Infrastructure Director, said that on the rare occasions train leave tracks like this, it can cause extensive damage, and unfortunately this incident is no exception. The additional problem with the ground conditions means that this is an especially complicated recovery process. I understand this will be extremely frustrating for passengers travelling between Lancaster and Barrow-Inverness. Across the rail industry, we're working hard to keep people on the move, though rail replacement buses, while we work as fast as we can to restore the railway for passengers and freight. Which is a good point, because this line is important, not only for those communities and the passengers who need the access, but also for the freight which does use the line, which includes the nuclear flask trains to and from Sellafield Power Station. The RIB hasn't specifically said yet whether this will form a full investigation, but I'll be honest, I'd be absolutely astonished if this wasn't the case. The threshold is very much met. The potential was there for this to be a much more serious incident, and arguably there's probably financially quite a bit of damage that's been done both to the trains and the infrastructure itself. Which leaves us with, like I said, three separate incidents with three different causes. But for me, understanding the circumstances of all three is of equal importance. They're not intrinsically linked by anything other than the fact that they involved a passenger train derailing. But passengers who are travelling on the railway absolutely should expect that their train will remain on the tracks. And while none of these resulted in serious injuries or worse, derailments really do result in those things. We've heard about it on the podcast on more than one occasion. We as an industry, but I'll certainly be paying close attention personally to the outcomes of these investigations, and I can promise you that it's not going to be the last time that we discuss these three on the podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finally, I'm going to take a hot minute to talk about an operator which has appeared on this podcast previously, West Coast Railways. On the 22nd of March, West Coast Railways issued a press release related to one of their premier services, the Jacobite, often referred to as the Hogwarts Express in bunny ears. That's due to the fact that it's steam-hauled and it passes over the Glenfinnan Viaduct, made famous to a whole new generation due to its prominent featuring in the movie series. And if you've seen a Harry Potter film, you will absolutely know what I mean. It's that glorious, curved, imposing viaduct with the Hogwarts Express steaming over it, and in some points a Ford Anglia flying on top of it. But anyway, the press release reads, "Update, Jacobite service. We are sorry that we need to cancel trips on our Jacobite steam train service 28th of March to the 1st of April 2024, dates inclusive. We are unable to offer alternative trips on the Jacobite at this time. Our reservations team will process full refunds for customers with bookings on those dates in the next 5 working days." And then a little bit about the payment methods, but the key part of the statement is, "This suspension of the service is due to a debate with the rail regulator about door locking. We share the regulator's commitment to safety, and our priority now is to work with it to renew permission to enable us to run the Jacobite on the main rail line. We hope to be able to operate scheduled future trips on the Jacobite, but we will contact all customers ahead of their journey date directly. In the event the trip they've booked will not run, in that case we will also issue a full refund. Which sounds like a fairly standard-ish business email, business press release. But we need to have a little look at the background of this incident to understand what's actually going on here. The phrasing of a debate with the regulator does somewhat downplay the issue at hand. And that issue is that West Coast Railways wishes to operate Mark 1 coaching stock on these services. Very aged stock, which we know because we've talked about it in episodes where we've covered accidents that took place a long time ago. But key to this is that the Mark 1 coaching stock as built lacks a very specific feature, CDL, central door locking. Central door locking, put very simply, is basically the system which prevents passengers from opening doors unless train crew have released them. And in short, they don't have the system fitted and the regulator has made it clear that it needs to be. The regulation that states that system needs to be in place is nothing new, but heritage stock has been somewhat surviving by virtue of grandfathered rights for some time. The change to safety regulations were made in 1999 after passengers were killed or injured by falling from the doors of Mark 1 trains, and some were hit by doors that were opened at platforms when the train was still coming to a stand. The debate, as WCR has referred it to, is actually much more serious. It's not just a discussion from two bodies over a table about it, or challengingly written emails going from one body to the other. It's actually tied into a whole sequence of legal actions. The ORR recently released a statement about this, saying that all heritage operators were told several years ago that in order to operate after the 31st of March 2023, they either needed to fit central door locking or obtain an exemption. West Coast Railway's application for an exemption failed, then they made a claim for judicial review. A temporary exemption was granted in order to maintain the status quo, enabling West Coast Railways to operate while the litigation reached a conclusion. And the fact of the matter is that litigation did reach a conclusion in December, when they challenged ORR's refusal to grant the exception, and the refusal was ruled as lawful. And that meant they couldn't operate the stock. The commercial manager at WCR, James Shuttleworth, said of that decision, "We are disappointed by the High Court's judgment. We have decades of experience of operating on the main line, and safety has always been and remains our top priority." Although we'll get to that in a second. "We will now reflect and consider options to enable us to continue running safe services enjoyed by many visitors from the UK and around the world, upon which local businesses along our routes rely. We are committed to working with the ORR to find a long-term solution which safeguards the future of heritage services on the main line. Our operational experience tells us that our safety measures, a steward for every four doors with secondary locks and monitoring, a train manager and a guard guarantee the safety of our passengers and colleagues. The ORR's decision to revoke our exemption would require us to install a modern safety system on carriages from a different era. The estimated cost of £7 million would be an extraordinary investment and would present a significant financial challenge for WCR." And, you know, my personal thoughts on this are somewhat mixed in a few ways. I love the idea of heritage railways, I really do. I think it's great to go to a heritage railway and get on a train from a different era and smell, experience it. It's great. But I don't know whether we can continue to accept heritage stock on the main line without putting the required controls in place. Yeah, WCR has its own processes. We've just heard them. But are they as good as a system which the industry mandated two decades ago? Probably not. There is something of a backlash, depending where you look, against the regulator for this decision. I mean, they've been painted as the bad guy for spoiling the situation for those who want the status quo to continue. The, you know, government regulator cancels the Hogwarts Express as a narrative. But I don't personally think that this is the case. In that statement from the ORR that I started off reading earlier, it goes on to say that WCR chose to sell tickets when it was far from certain that a new application for an exemption would be granted, either in time for the commencement of those services or at all. It submitted an exemption application on the 8th of March, which they're now assessing. The ORR is disappointed that WCR appears not to have made sensible contingency plans for the benefit of their customers. And when you boil it down, the fact is WCR has been operating on exemption, one that they received a long time ago, over a decade ago, and hasn't made the changes which would have prevented them from requiring the exemption. And one of the main concerns raised by WCR is the fact that this estimated cost of £7 million that would be required to make the changes that were needed. As a one-off expenditure, that is a massive expenditure. But considering the amount of times that, that CDL has been really required and just exempted against, a rolling scheme would have been much more attainable, especially for a business who, from a very cursory, and admittedly not a finance head, from a very cursory glance at their accounts, they increased their total equity by nearly £2 million between 2022 and 2023. If this had been a rolling scheme that could have been enacted over a 10-year period by this point, that might have been a more reasonable ask, instead of just continuously expecting the exemption to continue. And actually, WCR could probably deliver that change to a smaller number of trains, which would mean that cost wouldn't be £7 million, but actually a smaller amount, and it came up in court when this issue was being discussed. The ORR had an upper estimate to fill out four trains for daily use with CDL, and that was just under £1.4 million. The judge in the recent case said that adding a modest rise in the fares, amid them having a monopoly on these rail tours that they operate, should actually allow to pay for fitting the system in a phased manner. You know, for example, a £10 increase in the Jacobite fare, where the average return ticket is £46, would generate an extra £1 million a year in revenue with no additional overheads. And that's what Mrs. Justice Thornton said in court. She added as well that almost all other heritage train operators had accepted the requirement to install central locking, passing the cost on to customers, and that ORR was willing to offer a transition period for retrofitting. With all of that context, it does feel a bit like the operator is just stamping its feet and trying to get by without making the changes. And look, I'm clearly a rail enthusiast on some level. I would not spend my time doing this if I wasn't. But I personally fail to accept that the nostalgia factor can outweigh the safety benefits of making the change. But circling back round to the safety record of WCR, and I don't want to point fingers and criticise, but it's there, it's factual. West Coast Railways has not been without its share of safety incidents over the years. In October of 2020, one of their trains left York Station with the door open, and in a further incident in 2022, a passenger overpowered a steward to try and open a door while the train was moving. And that's just recent ones related to this. Let's not forget, it was a WCR service which nearly caused a major collision at Wootton Bassett in 2015, when Tangmere was running with its AWS system isolated, and that's something we managed to make an entire episode out of a couple of years ago. And that a similar situation in Doncaster later on in the same year led to a temporary suspension for the operator. In November 2015, an improvement notice was issued relating to health and safety risks, and on the 17th of February 2016, the ORR issued a prohibition notice to WCR preventing it from running heritage rail services on the mainline railway, and that related to concerns about their management of safety following a number of incidents. Under the terms of that notice, they weren't able to operate trains on the mainline network till the ORR was satisfied its governance and operations meet industry practice. They were required to introduce clearer governance structures, proper accountability for safety, more robust risk assessments, enhanced processes for managing staff with a focus on safety culture. It was a decision that the ORR didn't take lightly, Later in the year, they made improvements, the track access ban was lifted, and in 2018, they had a 5-year renewal on their safety certificate. But that's not the end of issues with West Coast Railways. Specifically, the Jacobite itself hasn't escaped issues in the past. On the 9th of June 2023, a safety inspector attended the Jacobite service and found issues which were considered a breach of health and safety. A prohibition notice was issued, coming into effect on the 15th of June, preventing them from running the Jacobite till the issues were rectified. And the ORR issued a statement at the time about this. A safety inspector from the Office of Rail and Road visited the Jacobite service run by West Coast Railway Company Limited on Friday the 9th of June 2023. This inspection found safety failings which ORR considered breached health and safety legislation, and accordingly ORR issued WCRCL with a prohibition notice which came into effect on the 15th of June 2023 and prevented it from running until WCRCL was satisfied it could rectify the issues raised in that notice. The Jacobite service recommenced on the 15th of June 2023. Safety inspectors from ORR subsequently visited the Jacobite service on the 14th of July. This inspection found safety failings which ORR considered breached the earlier prohibition notice and the conditions contained in West Coast Railway's Railway Safety Regulation Exemption Certificate. This type of exemption certificate is required for all train operators who want to use carriages without central door locking fitted. Ordinarily, heritage carriages are the type used on the Jacobite service. Due to the safety issues identified, ORR has revoked West Coast Railway's exemption certificate. West Coast Railways will continue to be able to use carriages without central door locking fitted on its other services in accordance with the conditions of a new exemption certificate. And the service was resumed on the 21st of August 2023. This was a prohibition notice that was issued exactly because of, to do with the same issue which is at debate now. So with all of this in mind, I don't think it's overly surprising that the CDL exemption was revoked. And I'm seriously doubtful, I wish I wasn't, I'm seriously doubtful of WCR's claims that their systems are equally as safe and effective as CDL would have been. Look, in closing thoughts on this issue, and actually for this episode as well, is that it's absolutely time for CDL exemptions to be brought to an end on anywhere other than low-speed heritage railways. And if an operator does want to operate their trains on the main line, it's 2024. It's time to suck it up and meet the requirements of the regulator for the ultimate safety of those who choose to use the trains. There is a reason the ask is there. These trains are supposed to be memorable, and they're supposed to be an experience that you remember for a lifetime. All this does is make sure that that is for the right reasons, and not because of something that is a painful memory when things go wrong. Safety comes first. It just has to. That brings me to the end of this week's roundup. Thanks as ever for coming to join us as we look at the most current of affairs of railway safety. Please come hang out in the virtual world of social media and join the conversation. I'm on Twitter and on Facebook, just search for Signals to Danger. And if email's your scene, daniel.fox@dfrailmedia.com. As ever, there are other ways you can support the podcast, through Patreon or buying merchandise. Head over to signalstodanger.com/support for more info. And remember, Patreon subscribers can listen to these episodes advert-free. That's it from me, and once again, until the next time you hear my voice, travel safe.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.